If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. You better watch.
Arr! It's Space Pirate Radio time. Puckos here on astronomy.fm radio. That means it is another Wednesday evening, and this one happens to be August the 23rd, 2017, 9:01 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, and that would make it universal time. August the 24th, Thursday morning, 1 o'clock in the morning, 2017. So that, of course, means you are listening to us live here on astronomy.fm radio, and that means, of course, that our chat room is wide open for you to board our starship Argo and get ready to cruise the universe for all the stuff that's out there. I'm out of words today. So far, we got in the chat room, we've got you and me, we've got Glenn, Black Projects, Plaid Sister, Plaid Joan, Optronics, Twist Edge. Glad to have you all here. Come on over to our chat room, astronomy.fm. You'll see where it says radio chat. Click on that, and that'll get you here and be part of our crew. You can ask questions, astronomy questions if you want to, or if we don't answer them on air, other people certainly will.
So there's one big pressing question tonight, Marty.
Okay.
How did you make out on the solar eclipse on Monday?
I did quite well with the solar eclipse on Monday. My plan pretty much worked out. I was planning on being mobile. Got a passenger co-driver, one of the members of the club, had a last-minute plan, said he wanted to do go along with me, so that was really good. Did a little camping, so did the whole trip pretty much on the cheap. Of course, the risk was I going to be able to find campsites? And no problem. Picked one southern part of Kentucky first off. Called them on the way down there, and they had a spot open. Yay! Now, it was probably one of the worst tent camping spots you could possibly get. It's like a pile of rocks on a hill.
Sounds appealing.
Yeah, that's not really good. Well, fortunately, one other camper nearby says, you know, they're going to sleep in their car. You want to swap? As they had like almost like a double campsite for tents. It's like, okay, sounds real good. So we swapped campsites, and so that made it real good. And then decided to head down to where Stephen Ramston from solarastronomy.org and the Charlie Bates Solar Astronomy Project, he was going to be. Originally, he was planning on being at a school, but the school canceled the event. I'll get into that a little later. So he was set up at a library in Hart County, Georgia.
Okay.
City of Hartwell.
Yes.
Yep, just right in the northeast corner of Georgia, reasonably well in the line. So the center line would have been 2:30. This was 2 minutes. So it looked good. The weather looked really good. Just watching the weather every time we stopped campground, check the weather through their Wi-Fi, and it looked like it was going to be a good spot. And I knew he had like a lot of solar telescopes.
I would think.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody has some, it'd be him.
That's right. So he had like a lot of people. Some people were just kind of stopping in, picking up solar glasses, and then heading on out to wherever they were observing. And a lot of them stayed. I think we had close to 2,000 people actually throughout the whole day. I'd say there was just a few hundred during totality. When we were there, most people kind of looked early and then kind of left out and went to various regions around the area. It was good. The skies were clear. Well, up to about a half hour before, then a huge cloud went across the sun.
Nice.
I said, okay, it was slow moving. I said, this is okay, because it's mostly clear around this cloud, and it's early enough for a cloud to go in front of the sun. I have seen pictures where, yes, clouds have gone in front of the sun right as totality was starting and wiped it out.
Yeah.
I wasn't too worried. Everything was working out pretty good. The weather patterns were looking really good. So I got to see it. It was a pretty spectacular eclipse, I would say. Everybody was saying that. Just the way the sun shone and the shape of the corona and everything, huge, huge prominence. Well, relatively large prominence, I should say, stuck off one corner of the sun. So it was really, really nice. So lucked out with a lot of things. Lucked out
very
with
cool.
Camp, last-minute camping spots. So, yeah, like I camped west of Atlanta, and they had a few camp spots left, so that worked out. That's what the plan was. And got some pictures. I can't figure. Can never figure out how to put them in our chat room here. But I think I put one in the Space Pirate Facebook page. So. And what's your story?
Well, so back in October, following a tip from a friend in the astronomy club, I'd booked a Holiday Inn in Grand Island, Nebraska, a place I'd never been, didn't really know much about, but it seemed like the hotel itself came with good recommendations from the friend. They only locked us into a 3-night stay instead of a 5-night stay, like some places. Mm-hmm. And Nebraska just seemed like a nice balance between hopefully better weather than the extreme east and not as nuts as Casper or Carbondale, both of which just seemed like too many people, too much hoopla, no thanks.
Mm-hmm.
So up till Thursday night, last Thursday, the weather prospects looked really good. Then by Saturday, suddenly Grand Island, Nebraska had the worst weather prospects of anywhere along the eclipse path.
Yep.
So we, some of our friends who were taking an RV down, they changed course and they ended up in Springfield, Tennessee. And some of our other friends who'd also booked a room there, you know, we got there and we're like, well, we're sticking it out. So we drove around Nebraska for a couple of days, just seeing the sights to kind of figuring out what other places might be viable and kept an eye on the weather forecasts. There's 4 different models of forecasting that we were referencing, and none of them agreed. So come the morning of the eclipse, we wake up. It's about 5 a.m, and my husband says to me, well, looks like the best place would be the agate fossil beds. That's at extreme western Nebraska up in the Panhandle. We were in central Nebraska, so we're talking 5.5 hours round trip through the storm, supposed storm, to get to clear skies.
Oh.
And at that point, we kind of looked at one another and we're like, yeah, whatever. Because we had a friend with us, co-worker that was staying with us. We had friends in Grand Island. And when we looked at some of the maps, it seemed like Grand Island would be in a rift in the clouds. Yes, Nebraska overall didn't look good, but Grand Island looked about as good as we could possibly do without driving 5.5 hours one way. So we went with there's a crane trust, Sandhill Crane Trust.
Okay.
On the south side of the freeway. Beautiful place. Very nice. They opened up the center. They had a food truck. Looked great. And that's where some of our friends from the astronomy club were set up. And we got there and we thought, you know what? The clouds to the south just don't look good.
Uh-huh.
North side of the sky, few high cirrus clouds, blue sky. Nice. To the south is like, So,
mm-hmm.
After about maybe 40 minutes there, we said, you know what? We'd love to stay here. It's beautiful, but we want to get on the other side of the freeway because at that point, the radar was indicating that the edge of the cloud band was just scraping Interstate 80, which runs east-west.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, back to the Grand Island, the city. We'll be on the right side of the freeway. I was looking up data from the Great American Eclipse 2017 website to figure out what intersection we could be at in Grand Island that was as far north as you could get and still be about 2 minutes, 30 seconds of eclipse time. Well, since we had a friend who was following us in a car, we pulled into the hotel at the parking lot. It was about 8 minutes before first contact, and we said, whatever. Got out our stuff, plopped it down in front of the hotel on the grass there, and saw first contact. Great. Cool. Mm-hmm. stuck it out a little more. There was a finger of cloud coming up from the southern horizon that looked like it was going to be trouble as we got closer to totality. But at that point, we were attracting quite a crowd because we were the only people on that side of the building with a hydrogen alpha scope.
Mm-hmm.
There was a family from Boston. They were doing solar projections.
Mm-hmm.
And there were quite a few people from Michigan, believe it or not. Celine.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other cities in Michigan, there was one of the people there turned out to be the very person who made the mounting rings for our club's telescope, Marty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So very, very interesting assemblage of people who happened to be at that holiday. So anyway, long story short, despite every terrible prediction about Grand Island being cursed, we saw gorgeous, glorious totality. Everybody was totally happy. My friend who had to leave to go back to Michigan as soon as the eclipse was over saw totality. We all raised a toast of Amarula liqueur, which is our club's tradition. He hopped in the car, made his plane, and we just celebrated. You know, we watched the whole remainder of the eclipse, which a lot of people did once totality was over. You know,
mm-hmm.
shut down, but. Mm-hmm. We watched the rest of the eclipse, and then it was party time. And the clouds rolled in for real that night, and at that point, I did not care.
And traffic-wise, you're okay going there? Some people get jammed up.
Yeah, well, we noticed a lot of cars with interesting plates on the I-80 to Grand Island. We were not in any traffic jams. Our friend, who again left immediately for Lincoln Airport, which is an hour and a half away from Grand Island,
mm-hmm.
he didn't have any problems. We did notice a fair number of cars on, say, US 30, so State Highway, 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, a whole lot of cars. I'm guessing that's probably not the norm for rural Nebraska. But we did see what seemed to be an unusual amount of traffic on certain arteries at night on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
We did visit some restaurants that were running out of certain foods. We did see an inordinate number of gas pumps that were not in operation in the smaller towns.
Mm-hmm.
Grand Island itself is 50,000 people, almost mm-hmm. 50,000 people. So I honestly didn't notice anything unusual. It was just maybe it was... Maybe the hotels were packed, but no problem getting restaurants, no problem getting gas, no problem with anything. The smaller towns, it wasn't crazy, but it mm-hmm. You could see there were signs that they were dealing with a lot more people than normal.
Mm-hmm. Traffic for me was mostly okay on the way down. We had a couple slow spots. Well, one slow spot, I think it was on Interstate. Yeah, it was Interstate 20. First there was a little accident, and we were almost on top of it, so it must have just happened. Got around that, and then after that, a little ways down the road, traffic was backed up for several miles. I was like going and going and going, and we got to where it started breaking apart, and there was a sign that said right lane closed. Well, the right lane wasn't closed. So some leftover construction sign jammed the road up for several miles and about a half hour's worth of stop and go traffic on the freeway for no purpose at all. So everybody was kind of getting over, trying to get ready for the stop and go traffic, which probably caused the first little accident that we came upon anyway. So yeah,
sure.
So a leftover traffic sign said one lane was closed, caused a freeway backup for a few miles for no purpose at all. At least that was on there, but had plenty of time. Everything was kind of well planned out. Found some country roads to travel onto. Country roads were just pretty much empty, two lane blacktops, moving 45 to 50 miles an hour. Did pretty good. The worst of it we saw was, we kind of took a back road out. We used the library. They pulled up some directions for us on getting to some freeways by avoiding Atlanta. As we're going around, I think kind of heading towards Knoxville at one point, and the traffic in the opposite direction was gridlocked. And we marked it for 25 miles.
Good Lord.
Gridlocked. So I could see some tires stopped for 25 miles. Glad we were in the other direction for that one. And we took the back roads that we actually did. So yeah, that was actually pretty bad. I kind of felt sorry for the truckers. You know, they're just doing their job working.
Yep.
And they got stuck in all that.
Indeed.
Heading home traffic.
Yeah, and being stuck in that ties into their fatigue rules and everything like that. So, yeah, that's no fun.
Yep. So that also made a lot of the rest areas filled up with trucks. The truck side was full of trucks, and the car side was full of trucks, too.
I can't blame them.
Yeah, definitely. So they're required to rest. They had to rest. You know, what can you do?
Go ahead. One of the reasons we picked Nebraska was simply the abundance of east-west roads with the north-south arteries connecting them, so that in the event that we did have to flee the weather, we could pull it off without dealing with mountains or, you know, impassable rivers or anything like that. So thankfully, we never had to use any of those contingency plans, but yeah, Nebraska is really good about the country roads. It would have been very doable.
Mm-hmm. I did notice, I looked on some maps, and the northwestern portion of Nebraska is quite empty.
Well, that's sandhill country. And okay. I don't mean the cranes, I mean sand hills.
Okay.
And we thought about going there just to see them, except it was something like 3 hours from the hotel. Mm-hmm. And that seemed a little bit much for a joyride when we might have to do it the following day for real.
Mm-hmm.
And then when push came to shove and it was like, well, we might have to go all the way out to, you know, nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to do it. Yeah, so we saw an outcrop of sand hills near Kearney, which is one of the forts, old forts along the Oregon Trail. But yeah, sand hill, I'll tell you, Nebraska was fascinating, and I intend to go back for the bird migration because we really liked it.
Yeah,
and nice. We really want to see that sand hill country up there.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, so we've been hyping the solar eclipse for a year, Marty.
Yes.
So.
We can kind of reduce it down a little bit here now, yes.
As a veteran of solar eclipses, what was your experience with the apparition of this particular eclipse?
Kind of like what I was reading with everybody, this one was amazing. The moon seemed darker, the corona seemed better, it had a super bright, prominence, there just seemed to be visually more detail in the corona itself than I remember from any other eclipse, and I think everybody was thinking the same thing. This was the best looking total eclipse.
I was blown away by the colors. I was blown away by the just profound, complete blackness of the lunar disk. That was possibly the blackest black I have ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the sky, I've seen some articles calling it, you know, purple, violet. I would say in Grand Island, it was like a periwinkle blue. I mean, it was a very soft, luminous blue with maybe a tinge of lavender to it, but it was basically the color that you see very often at twilight.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, around the horizon, it was like a sunset glow. It was, you know, peach and orange.
Mm-hmm.
So it was incredibly colorful.
I was in an area where there's kind of a bit of trees surrounding me, so I didn't get the good horizon view. So I could kind of tell where the moon shadow was coming from, and after it passed, I could kind of tell that. But I did not have any horizon indication at all. I forgot to look for shadow bands. Somebody actually videotaped some shadow bands.
My husband saw shadow bands on the hood of a white Chevy that was in the parking lot.
That would do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about preparing for shadow bands, having something white laying out.
Oh, we had a sheet. There were very high winds.
Okay.
Very high winds enough that my PST, my solar telescope, on a very heavy surveyor's mount was shaking.
Mm.
And the winds only picked up as we got closer to totality. So it was very windy. Mm-hmm. I would not have had a Dobsonian reflector out in that kind of weather.
Mm-hmm.
But so we had a sheet held down with rocks to see the shadow bands. And it turned out that the thing that actually worked was the hood of that Chevy.
Ah, nice. Now I was kind of looking at so much and getting so much stuff ready that, well, with all the crowds there, kind of doing a solar outreach thing for people coming by. Stephen had one mount with three telescopes on, hooked up to hydrogen alpha, white light, and calcium, all in one telescope. And then he had another another mount set up the same way, but all these had videos going to separate computers under a tarp there, so people could actually look at the image through cameras. And so that was basically part of the outreach thing, where they would go look through the telescope and they could go look at the computers. And I was helping to explain the different views through on the different computers, the different video cameras. So we got to see it in different light. It was kind of neat. I didn't get a chance to look for first contact through hydrogen alpha because I forgot. And all of a sudden I thought, when is it starting? I looked up with, you know, the solar glasses, go, oh, it started. And everybody, you know, yelled out and everybody starts, you know, putting on their glasses and starting looking up. Then I got real busy right around the last couple minutes watching through my solar binoculars, watching that crescent getting thinner and thinner, watching the end start breaking up. And then I didn't even review my video yet, but I got the last bits of Bailey's beads and diamond ring through my video camera, which I think it was kind of washed out though. What do you call it when it overpowers the chip?
Oversaturated.
Saturated. Yes, sure. I think I got that part was actually saturated. And I left my video camera running, and then went to the still camera. I did some still shots, various things. I only took about 3 or 4 pictures of totality though, because I really wanted to look more than anything else. So I had my standard binoculars out there to look after totality. And again, that's when I noticed more detail in the corona. Definitely saw Regulus right next to the sun.
Yep. I saw with binoculars.
I thought, what else was out there? Was it
Mercury?
Mercury, yep. I didn't see that.
I saw Mercury only with binoculars. I could not see it naked eye for the life of me.
Okay. And then we did see Jupiter off to the east. Did not.
We had clouds there. That is where the patch of clouds was hanging out, which was cool when the sun retreated, because that patch of clouds was what was right in the shadow path. So it was hanging there black after we were already in sunlight again. So that was neat, but it blocked out Jupiter.
And I didn't. Yeah, I had trees in the way of Venus, so I
couldn't. Oh my God, Venus was gorgeous.
I know, it's so bright.
Venus was spectacular.
And there was something else right next to on the west side of the sun too. But I can't remember. Was it Mars?
Yeah, I didn't see Mars. Nobody with me saw Mars. If you saw Mars, good luck, or congratulations, because none of us could see it.
This is so fast. By the time you looked at stuff and get your brain to absorb something or try to move on to something like that, it was pretty much over that fast. So
it was the quickest 2 minutes and 30 seconds I think I can remember. I mean, just looking up and then the diamond ring effect started. It's like, oh my God, already? It didn't seem possible.
I know. Especially when you're doing extra things like, you know, managing, switching from binoculars to the camera, trying to take a couple of pictures, trying to change a couple of settings. That's why I didn't want to change too many settings on my camera, because I knew that was going to basically burn up a lot of time trying to get some different types of pictures through my camera. So I got some that were decent and some that didn't work out. So that's okay. I still have to look at the video and see how that ran too. Usually I'm with a bunch of amateur astronomers, and of course you get the amateur astronomer yelling out during totality, and I was mostly with the general public, and they really yelled out during totality. I think most of them had not seen an eclipse before. Usually I'm with, you know, people that have seen several eclipses in this whole group, but nobody that's seen a total eclipse before.
My husband set up a video not to look at the sun, purely to record everybody's reactions.
Nice.
It was funny. But you know what? There were people who instinctively, as soon as totality hit, they dove for my telescope. And he had to shout to get them away from my telescope. It's a, you will not see, look up.
Exactly. Because your scope was made to block out sunlight, and yeah, the moon already did that.
Yes. Hydrogen alpha scope during a total solar eclipse? No.
Mm-hmm. Now, it would be interesting to see if you could see, like, the prominence through your scope only. That would be interesting. But we'll never know, will we?
Oh, well, Jonathan did a test, actually.
Okay.
Because nobody in the club could answer his question, which was, can you see Bailey's beads in hydrogen alpha?
Okay.
The answer should be no.
Really? I thought it would be yes.
He could not.
Okay. Should be yes because Bailey's beads are basically the photosphere.
Yeah.
So you should be able to pick that up in hydrogen alpha. Interesting. Maybe you had to videotape it to really review it a little bit better.
That could be. And, of course, you know, we did have a clock drive. We were using my surveyor's mount. We weren't videotaping. He took some great photos through the eyepiece with the cell phone.
Oh, nice. But,
yeah, we were not doing any sort of, live video. The only video we did was of the crowd.
Nice. I got two main pictures of the eclipse. One was a little overexposed. He tried to pick up that prominence and turned out it was too overexposed, kind of washed out a little bit. And then just one right in the middle of it. Just got a general picture, which I think is on our Space Pirate Facebook page right now anyway. So could use a little bit of processing too. A little grainy. The point and shoot camera is that way. So, but it's okay. I had to see it. It was pretty spectacular. And everybody, of course, the question next is, when is the next one?
When is the next one, and where is the next one, Marty? Where in the world is the solar eclipse happening next?
I've heard it's in Chile. I'm going to have to pull my book and double-check that, but that's what I've heard yet. Go ahead and give a few seconds, and I'll pull my book out.
Okay. So, yes, next one is going to be 2019. And it's not going to be a great North American solar eclipse. It will be looks like going through Chile, which my husband, and Argentina.
Okay.
So my husband is already plotting to go south for this one because we have meant to visit Chile and Argentina for a very long time. Some of my ancestors actually came through Chile. And we would like to visit the observatories down there, and to visit the solar eclipse in the process would be amazing. Now, the period of the greatest eclipse is actually out in the middle of the ocean.
Okay.
So you would need to be on a boat.
Which is potentially might happen.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I'd like to do a shout out. Astronomers Without Borders, they are collecting solar glasses. So if you have solar glasses in good repair, meaning they're not torn, you didn't touch the lenses, check out Astronomers Without Borders and get them shipped down to the people who will be seeing the next eclipse, because you could hang on to glasses for 7 years until one comes through North America again, but other people could definitely make use of them in the meantime.
Sounds good. I'll pass it on to Stephen. He had some left over.
Yeah, and just throwing that out there. Got a lot of solar eclipse glasses floating around, and we got people who could definitely make use of them in 2019.
Nice. All right, so this must be the July 2nd, 2019 eclipse. Looks like it starts almost at Australia, but out in the middle of the ocean. Goes across the Southern Pacific, and then ends up going across South America, so that would put it somewhere around a sunset. I think.
I'd like to see that.
On where you're at, so that's a little tricky because you might see, it looks like you'll see the partial phases in sunset, so maybe when it exits out, I think that's what it is, you'll see it set in partial phase. So you won't get to see the entire eclipse from South America, according to this chart. So you get partial phase beginning, totality, and then it'll set. So that can be kind of a rough one, too. Missing some of it. You're going to have good size. You know, a lot of mountains out there, Chile. Mm-hmm. You better be on the sunny side of the mountains.
Good point.
Down there, or out in some plains or something like that. So that'll be a little tricky, of course, right on the ocean, Pacific Ocean coast. But what's a cloud situation like that? This is the kind of the middle of winter time down there.
That is true. And in fact, that's a problem with the North American eclipse of 2024. It's April.
Mm-hmm.
April is really iffy for a lot of the places in the U.S. and Canada that it's going to. And Jonathan even looked up the forecast for Mexico because we thought, ooh, let's see it for Mexico. Yeah, weather prospects not so good there either. So this was, if you missed this one, cross your fingers because April is just not that reliable.
Exactly. Got lots of annulars coming up. That's cool. Also 2019, December is annular going through, what's that, Malaysia?
Yep. Oh.
Looks like Malaysia. It's going to be an annular going through there, across the southern tip of India, and then through Malaysia. I've got an annular 2020 going through, let's see, like Saudi Arabia, through northern India, and then looks like out through China, an annular 2021. I think that one's going to be, that's almost polar, so that'll be partial just in Europe. So, but I don't think anybody's going to get the annular except you're around the North Pole regions, Greenland, something like that. Lots of partials coming up. Hybrid going across. Oh, it's 2023, going across, where is it going across, Southeast Asia?
Why don't you explain a hybrid for everybody's benefit?
Okay. Oh, it's a little bit wrong. Again, that was like Malaysia, just north of Australia. Hybrid is mostly an annular. If you're on the center line, the beginning parts of it will be annular. The ending parts of it will be annular. But if you're right in the center, you'll get a few seconds of totality. So you have to be just in the right spot. And it's hard to say how long, how many seconds just by this chart. It doesn't really say. So you might get anywhere from, 15 to 30 seconds of total, but mostly it's going to be annular. So you have to be like right on the center point of the center line to get a total, and it won't be very long at all. The one in 84 in South Carolina, I think it was really close to that. Not quite, but it was almost a total, or almost a hybrid, but mostly an annular. Annular in 2023 going across southwestern U.S. Annulars aren't too bad, actually. So anywhere from, looks like, again, maybe Washington, Portland, down through Texas.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the annular that I saw 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
definitely would want to do that again.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see how well the 2024 one is. A lot of prepping to do. Again, that would be one to get ready to travel. And that's what I did. So I had some options where I wanted to go. Was ready to travel if it was going to be washed out, and kept track, and it worked fine. Well, let's do a little station break here. You are Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is another Wednesday evening, and this one just happens to be August the 23rd, 2017, 9:34 in the evening. For those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, universal time, that would put it at 1:34 August the 24th, Thursday morning, again, 2017. You're still listening to our live portion program, about another half hour of that. Don't forget, though, we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours with our usual lineup of programming, which should include Astronomy Ireland, Naked Scientist, Planetary Radio, and Naked Astronomers. Is it Naked Astronomy? Yeah. Something like that. Anyways, yeah. More programming coming. Get Naked coming up after Space Pirate Radio. Now, some people are asking about the temperature. Did we get the temperature drop? I didn't notice because it was so hot. I didn't know what the temperature was, but it was probably in the upper 80s at least, if not lower 90s where I was at. I should look that up. So we were pretty much cooking in the sunlight anyways. And a little bit of surrounded by some, we're on the grass, but kind of surrounded by asphalt. So I didn't really notice a major drop more than like stepping into the shade and not getting direct sunlight on you. So I don't think the temperature really dropped that much. Other people said they noticed it, but.
You must have had more humidity because so it's high noon. Mm-hmm. Without daylight savings time. It would have been high noon at totality. And it had been in the high 80s and 90s the previous couple of days. That particular day, I think it was supposed to hit a high of 85, not taking the eclipse into account. But the chilling was very noticeable as we approached totality. It was, as I said, it was windy. And so the wind picked up. The air was dry as opposed to, say, Kentucky or Tennessee or a place like that where it can be very humid. So the air was dry. It was windy, it got chilly, and then, oh my God, at about halfway out of the eclipse, it just felt so brutal. I was very tempted to start taking our unnecessary things and taking them inside the hotel just to get out of the sun. I ended up crouching underneath the folding chair that we bought because it just got so hot so fast once the moon shadow left.
I don't know. I'm kind of more used to heat. A lot of the work I do and stuff like that is out in the heat. So I guess I'm kind of used to it. Maybe that's why I didn't really notice a huge difference, or maybe there wasn't. But no big deal. It was definitely hot early, throughout the whole day, and it was still hot. I'm kind of used to that. Let's take a look at the sun.
It had some spots on it Monday.
It did have spots on it Monday.
Nice prominences.
Yes, there was a really nice sunspot group pretty much right through the middle of the sun. That was active region 2671. Not a lot of big spots, but a bunch of little spots. And there was like
a lot of freckles.
A lot of three of them were Earth size. That was kind of nice. Right on the edge of the sun, active region 2672. Was there. It was kind of nice. Both regions showed well in calcium as active regions. 2672 is now about halfway to the center of the sun. So that means you got some good solar viewing right now. And as that big group gets towards the edge of the sun in another couple of days, might be worth looking at it with some hydrogen alpha telescopes. And if it does get active, you might get some nice prominences come out of it. So right now, the sun looks pretty nice as far as sunspots goes. And I would assume hydrogen alpha will give us some nice views too. So a little bit of potential flaring, I think, from 2672. So it's a good time for checking out the sun. This whole week and a half coming up is going to be real nice. Solar winds are just moderate at 446 kilometers per second, and particle density kind of down there at 4.57 protons per cubic centimeter. So not much going on there. A little bit of activity, but nothing really spectacular with the sun right now. Let's see. Coming up, planets and the moon and stuff like that. Friday the 25th, we got Jupiter 3 degrees south of the moon. Saturn stationary, which means in our orbit we're kind of going straight towards it for right now, so no forward or no retrograde motion. Juno's out there also. That's stationary, so gotta be pretty close to Saturn. On Saturday, Mercury is an inferior conjunction. That doesn't mean it's going to go in front of the sun. That just means its position is lined up with the sun. Tuesday, first quarter moon. Wednesday, the moon's at apogee, farthest away in its orbit. And then next Wednesday also, Saturn will be south, 4 degrees south of the moon. Still planets to look at out there, so get out and do some observing. I didn't get a chance to look for that thin crescent moon afterwards because...
I was tired. I was done.
I was zombie tired, too, for at least a day and a half because I decided to do the almost straight-through drive on the way back.
Ooh.
Yeah, so just drove as far as we could and got into somewhere in Ohio, north of Toledo, I think, and then just hit the rest area and leaned the seats back for a snooze for a few hours, enough rest to get back home. We're still awake because, pumping a lot of caffeine. So it was like sleeping on and off for a few hours all day. What was it? Tuesday. And finally a little bit normal today, but still not quite evened out my sleep, but pretty close. Yeah, yesterday was pretty brutal with sleeping and waking up in the middle of the night, sleeping in the middle of the day and getting used to everything again. So that was kind of tough. So we got space rock coming this way. Let's see what's coming up. A couple things are coming. Let's see. Well, right now there was one that came by today. It was only 1.4 lunar distances away. So lunar distance is 240,000 miles. Add a half of that, make it about 320 some thousand miles away. Not real big though. It was only about 30 feet in diameter. So nothing too special about that. Got one coming up on August 31st. It's about 1.25 million miles away. And this one is about 120 feet across. Got a big one flying by, but it's also really big one flying by on September the 1st, but it's pretty far away. It's about 4.5 million miles. That's pretty far. But it's 3 miles in diameter. That's a big rock.
That's big. Yeah.
Four and a half million miles away.
I'm glad it's 4 million miles away.
Yeah, definitely. And then a small one, but a really close one on October the 12th. It is about 50 feet in diameter, but it's only going to pass by at 1/10 of the distance to the moon. So that puts it at about 25,000 miles away from us, within the range of geosynchronous satellites, 50 miles across. I haven't heard anything, you know, significant about where it's going to fly by, so I assume that none of the geosynchronous satellites are in danger of those collisions with this one. It's almost like 50 feet. Well, that's pretty much like a satellite flying by us anyways. No big deal. So some stuff's flying a little bit close and some stuff's not. Oh, just before that, September 29th, got one that's 1,200 feet across.
Oh.
It's like getting close to a quarter mile, and it's 2 million miles away from us at closest approach. There's some rocks out there, but nothing really fun that, you know, is big enough and close enough to actually see. I think 3 miles across at 4 million miles, 4.5 million miles. I don't think that's going to be bright enough for us to see, but I'll keep track of that information. We still got a couple more weeks before that one gets close and see if I can figure out how bright it's actually going to be. Check that one out. Let's see. All right, let's see what we got here. I got an article to end with for you.
Cool. So, well, since you've got an article, I've got something. I've got an update on everybody's favorite or least favorite star surrounded by so-called alien megastructures.
Okay.
But it's not a news article. What happened was we were one of the towns that we came into while we were touring Nebraska was the town of Kearney. And Fort Kearney, which is nearby, was on the Oregon Trail. So there was a museum there. We went in and talked to the ranger, picked up a flyer. Turned out that a speaker in town that very night was Tabitha Boyajian, aka nice. Tabby from Tabby's Star. So she had connections to the local university there. And so they were hosting a free public lecture at the local performing arts center. And so we got to see her. Nice. And it turns out she is a wonderful speaker, and she was presenting up to date, as in 24-hour-old data, on her star.
Nice.
Very cool. So, which it's still weird. The star is still being weird. We're not going to mention the A word, but. that was another unexpected and very fun highlight of going eclipsing in Nebraska.
Yes. Let's see. A couple articles here. Where is this one? recently discovered, I think was a white dwarf that went supernova.
What?
But it looks like, yes, the white dwarf is still there.
That story. Okay.
Let me pop this into our chat room here.
By all means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, type 1A supernovas are kind of what are called a standard candle because they pretty much all explode the same way or predictably. If you know what, I don't know if there's little differences in them, but generally all the same.
They all detonate at pretty much the same mass when the white dwarf with a binary companion sucks off.
Yep.
Just enough from its companion that it hits a actual physical tipping point and goes boom.
Chandrasekhar limit.
Yep, 1.4 solar masses.
Yes. So when it pulls enough stuff from the companion to be that heavy, quote unquote, sort of, or that massive, I should say, yes, it explodes. And then since they pretty much all have the same amount of material on them when they explode, that they all explode with pretty much the same relative brightness. Well, if you're looking at one in a distant galaxy and you can tell by its spectra that's a type 1A supernova, all you have to do is compare how bright it is, looks in your scope, to how bright it should be if it was at a certain distance, and then you can calculate how far that galaxy is. Well, not this time, because it appears that not all of them completely explode. You can read the article, but yes, it looks like some of them do a subluminous supernova, and it can actually leave the white dwarf back behind, and this one estimated that now it's at a mass of 0.14 solar masses, which puts it at about 8% as wide as our sun, or 8.5 times larger than the Earth itself. So not all of them are going big time boom. Definitely some smaller ones.
I still won't want to be anywhere in the vicinity, thanks.
Well, it's got to be relative. Relatively speaking, it might not be too bad.
Well, I'll go for you in the chat room, who joined while we were talking about the eclipse, says, we are so due for a supernova. Yes, we are indeed.
I think so, yes. Just close for us to see, preferably around the celestial equator. So
everybody can see it. Yeah,
northern,
that'd be
southern
nice.
Hemisphere. Yep, that would be good.
And preferably not with the poles aimed directly at us. Thanks. Mm,
that's right. So that would be nice if we actually got one that we can do a little observing with. And more people can do it than the last one, which is back in 1987, the Large Magellanic Cloud, I think it was.
Yep.
All right, let's see where we got. Another article here. Where did it go? It's about the sun. Astronomers detail the nature of solar brightness variations. Get this article here. Basically, two methods that the sun gets brighter and dimmer. One of them is through magnetic fields. Magnetic fields will make bright spots on the sun or dark spots on the sun. So that will actually change the brightness of the sun itself. And not just for the sun, but also other stars. And the other method is, sunspot. Oh, and basically stuff coming up from below. Convection. Flows of hot plasma within the sun. Granulation, stuff like that. So those two methods are the main ways of the sun will actually gets brighter and dimmer. So one particular problem with looking for exoplanets is by measuring the brightness of the star as a planet goes across it, and it actually gets dim for a little bit. So, well, they have to kind of figure out if the dimming also might be a variability in the star itself. So they have to kind of calculate is that star slightly varying? Is it varying because of, you know, again, stuff basically just welling up from below, or is it varying because of magnetic fields, or is it varying in brightness because of a planet going across its surface? Read this article, and I put it in our chat room. Where is this from? SciTech Daily. So they're getting a little bit more research done on how stars actually variable, getting it down to a lot higher degree of accuracy.
Cool.
Be able to figure out.
Yep. The more you know, the more you realize how little we know.
That's right.
Yeah, we actually got, I'm not going to call it a crank call because the guy was sincere, but received a call shortly before the eclipse started on Monday.
Okay.
From the west side of Michigan, which that's not where we're located, but our club is easy to find online. And he was very concerned because he had been taught in school, so he said, that a shadow either went in a straight line or expanded. And if the moon is a quarter the size of the sun, then how on earth was, you know, only this tiny band of the Earth's surface going to be experiencing a total eclipse? It should have been, you know, a vast chunk of the Earth's surface in eclipse. And so I explained to him, it's like, it's a three-dimensional system. There's some models on the NASA website that can help you. But, you know, the upshot is the umbra, the dark part of the shadow, is an inverted cone. And the penumbra is huge, but it doesn't make for a very good eclipse. So it was...
Did you get to answer his question?
We agreed to disagree, I guess. he was very adamant that he had been taught things a particular way and liked to know what school that was. Not going to say that they're... I thought about bringing up the whole thing about, well, you know, depending on what grade you learn that in... I was taught the Bohr model of the atom in 1992, well after everybody knew that that was not true, but hey, sometimes it's hard to get 12-year-olds to visualize what's actually going on with particle physics.
That's right.
So they tried out the Bohr model, which is not correct, but it helps you to get the idea. So that's actually something that's always kind of bothered me with science and math, is there's a certain limit of, well, you're too young to really understand this concept. Not just age, because very young children don't necessarily have abstract logic.
That's correct.
That develops. So if you're teaching 9-year-olds, abstract logic may not be the route to go.
Mm-hmm.
So you bring out models. You bring out models that you know are wrong, but they help. And then you build on that and you build on that. But you know, as you're going through class, there's a certain bait and switch feeling to it. I felt that myself, despite loving science. Like, hey, you're just telling us that everything that we learned in seventh grade is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, that turns into a deal breaker.
Yes. How old was this person, you know?
Really couldn't tell from the voice. I would say anywhere from mid-30s to mid-50s.
Okay. So it was an adult, was not a student.
And, oh, no, it was not a student. This was somebody who had learned something. And again, I thought of the Bohr model, which I don't know if they teach that in schools today. But it's like, well, he could have been taught a simplified model that is technically speaking wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Could have been a while since he was in school.
Mm-hmm. Or that long ago, your memory changed about what your perception was.
Right. I mean, he was correct. The shadow is huge.
Yes.
But it's still not going to generate a total solar eclipse.
Mm-hmm. One way of thinking about it is if the sun was a point source, then the shadow would be the size of the moon on the Earth. So it would be basically, 20, what's the diameter of the moon? 2,100 miles? Something like that. So yes, if the sun was a point source, the shadow would be the diameter of the moon itself going across the Earth. But because it's not a point source, that eliminates that changes the size of the shadow and makes it smaller. You can basically do the same experiment on the ground, on anything out in the sunlight, like your finger or a pencil or a marble or something like that. Put it on a table or on the ground or something like that. Look at the shadow. as you pull the object away from the surface, you'll actually see the shadow getting smaller. That's because the sunlight is not a point source, so it's actually going around the object, and it's actually getting to the surface. The farther away you pull your finger away from the surface, or a marble away from the surface on the ground, that the shadow gets smaller and smaller, and then basically when it's too far away, there's no umbral shadow at all, no dark shadow. It's all sort of a barely shadow, but you have more sunlight than you do a shadow. That's the best way to experiment. If you look at your shadow, you'll notice that on Earth, shadows do not have a hard edge. They're fuzzy. That's because of the diameter. The sun has a diameter to it. So sunlight actually comes around the object the closer the object is to the sun. Try that experiment and just see it. You'll notice that the distance for objects is a proportion that's all the same, but the distance can be different, obviously. All right, getting real close here. Well, I've got one for you coming up here. You
all
ready?
Right. All right, unleash it.
All right, here we go. Do you think that an Australian mountain might actually have a pyramid inside of it?
Oh, God. Oh, no. I know what you're doing.
Here we go. I have to do a pyramid story for you, of course.
Yes, to keep me on my toes every now and again.
Yeah, and this, of course, is a little bit
for Glenn. Do your worst.
Yes, Glenn thought the music earlier sounded like it was from Australia, so it was kind of...
God, it's the Daily Mail. Marty, you're cruel.
So, yes, there's some claims that this mountain hill in Australia, because it's kind of got some sharp ridges on it, that some people are claiming that inside of it is actually a pyramid built by the Egyptians that were visiting Australia. And I think, how do you build a pyramid when you're visiting? You basically have to live there in order to build a pyramid. Okay. I love throwing questionable science and, let's just say, non-science pyramid stories at you.
I was Aqua for You is saying in there, Diane is a healthy skeptic. I did not used to be. I believed a lot of things when I was quite young. And one of those things was I was quite interested in it, not Atlantis so much, because I thought Atlantis was silly. But Lemuria, now that I thought was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't a silly thing that Plato obviously made up to tell some elaborate metaphor, that Lemuria might be legit. You've got tales of lost Phoenicians sailing around and spreading Phoenician culture through the... And then even worse, aliens visiting Australia and Easter Island and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm well familiar with the Egyptian pyramid in Australia.
You've heard this one before?
I've heard this one before.
All right. I'll keep
looking
for more.
Thank goodness I have some beer. I'm surprised to see it pop up again, because it's a well-worn... I see that this particular take on it, courtesy again of the Daily Mail, not my favorite
reliable news source.
Yeah, it's like I have a hard time even saying news source.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a group of Egyptians visiting Australia 5,000 years ago. Right, now you tell one.
They built a pyramid. Yes, sir. I know. I love doing those kind of stories for us. Good way to end the show.
Yep.
All right, everybody. Time for us to get out of here. Really appreciate you all listening in. Don't forget, we're going to repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. And coming up with our usual lineup, Astronomy Ireland, and the usual shows coming up after us. So keep tuned in. I want to say thanks to our crew in the chat room tonight. Appreciate you all being in here, being part of the chat room. And we'll keep on going, and we'll see you all next Wednesday for another adventure of Space Pirate Radio Arr. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night. Clear skies, y'all.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.